Welcome, everybody. Today is the next session of Ontology Summit 2013. Today is 28th February of that same year, 2013. This is Track B, which is focusing on extrinsic aspects of ontology evaluation. And we are continuing that subject with no special agenda other than to address that. We have three speakers today, including myself and Terry Longstreth. We have Dr. Gianpaolo Almeida. Hopefully I pronounced your name correctly. Please correct it for us when you present. He'll be talking to us on assessing ontologies via simulation. Dr. Almeida is an associate professor at the Computer Science Department of the Federal University of Espírito in Espírito Santo in Brazil. Then we have Keith Silliman, who spent many decades in the area of evaluating performance and measurement of performance in systems and integrations thereof. And we have Dr. Amanda Visidum, who has extensive knowledge in actually building ontologies and testing them or evaluating them. Subsequently, we will be hearing a wide range of topics, and hopefully it will be very informative. Terry, do you have anything to say? Okay, I take that as a no. Well, then, Peter, if you would go to the first set of slides. Unfortunately, I can't get VNC to run, so I'm trusting that everyone is now seeing our first slide, whose title is Life Cycle Trinsics Game. So if you recall from last week on the chat box, chat board, I put in a little question that occurred to me while listening to the talks, in that I had not heard an explicit description of when the various trinsics, as I'm calling them, might be applied or be applicable. Now, of course, the categorization of all these evaluation criteria and or methods, we grouped into these things called trinsics, and they're both extrinsic and intrinsic, and as Leo pointed out to us, there's sort of an in-between area, too. Now, these categorizations are rather crude. However, even so, it has not been addressed whether and or where they should be applied. So if you would go to the second slide, what I have here is a couple of views of life cycle phases. The model on the left comes from NIST, and the model on the right is actually a MITRE model. And in the notes sections of the slides, you'll find the references to them. Now, of course, each of these models is lacking something. That is, the degree of granularity and the subdivision may not be appropriate for your particular application. However, in general, they're covering most of the things that have to be addressed in the system development. So now, again, these are just two views. You can have other views if you like. If you go on to slide three, here we have one description of these trinsics, a la Leo's from last week's presentation by him, where an intrinsic evaluation or criteria requires little or no domain knowledge. Then there are the tweens, in between intrinsic and extrinsic. Some domain knowledge is needed, and you're going to explore the ontology a little bit. And then the extrinsic characteristics or criteria. We then think of the ontology as a black box, and we'll examine it from that perspective. Okay. Well, if these are all the trinsics that are available to us, the questions become, if you go on to slide three, please, how might you apply the trinsic? Or I should say, when would you apply the trinsics? Are you going to apply intrinsic criteria initially when you're conceiving of the thing that you're going to build? Well, probably not. And then similarly, how much of those trinsics are you going to apply? Again, this categorization of intrinsic, extrinsic, and in-betweens, well, there's lots of criteria that fall into those things and fall in between. So which ones are you going to apply? And or, you know, from a crude assessment, how much are you going to apply? A lot of intrinsic assessment criteria at the beginning, or are you going to apply it at the end? You're going to apply it in the middle or where, or so on, something like that. And then how many of each of those should you apply? So if we go on then to the fourth slide, slide number four. I think I misnumbered my slides. Okay, on slide number four, it should be the last slide, Peter. I'm sorry for the misnumbering. Here's the game, and I'm couching it as a game because of the complexity involved. The range of criteria or evaluation that you might want to apply, independent of whether they're intrinsic, extrinsic, or in between, could be quite large and could be quite small. When you want to apply them, when they need to be applied, and how much of each you want to apply or need to apply is going to vary wildly depending on what you're trying to do. What's the end goal? How big is the system you're going to build? How small? How many pieces do you have to integrate? How many people, organizations involved? What's your budget? What's your time? So on. So there's no simple answer, I believe. Subsequently, it sort of looks like a game. Can you maximize your return? So which of the intrinsic or extrinsic or in-between evaluation criteria or evaluation methods or methodology are you going to apply at the identification stage? And if you like, the identification stage, if you're not familiar, is when your customer or your organization or whomever thinks up the thing that you want to do in the first place. And then you go in to refine it in terms of the conceptual understanding of what you want to do and the things that have to be done. And then the requirements get more specific. So if you like, this is going down from the very general, the very fuzzy at the identification stage down to something more specific requirements, then you get down to more specific. So again, going from general to specific, going down there. And then in the build stage, well, as I mentioned, this is one view of the engineering or life cycle phases, and that, in fact, encompasses a whole bunch of stuff, which the V diagram from MITRE sort of decomposes a bit. And then there's the operation phase, and very nicely, as they put here at the bottom of this particular diagram, there is the re-engineering. That is, you have your system out in the field, it's doing stuff, oops, the customer has, or the users have come up with new requirements, or they've discovered some errors that weren't addressed earlier, so you have to go back and redo things. So that might require modifying your ontology and or the systems that support it, and then so on. So here's the game. Have at it. Have a nice day. So with that, to make sure that every one of our speakers has sufficient time for their presentations, we're going to go on to Dr. Almeida. So, Doctor, if you would start. Peter, if you would change to Dr. Almeida's slides. Star 7 to unmute.
All right. I hope you can hear me now. This is João Paulo Almeida from the Federal University of Espírito Santo in Brazil. I will be talking today about our work that we have developed at the Ontology and Conceptual Modeling Research Group on assessing ontologies via simulation. There's a bit more than just simulation, as we'll see. This is work on this track B on extrinsic aspects of ontology evaluation. And what we are looking at here is that we intend to run, let's say, an ontology to be able to increase our confidence in the quality of whatever we wrote in this ontology. So if we go to slide 2, I can discuss some of the motivation in our work. So first, very importantly, we see domain ontologies or their representation in conceptual models as a means to represent whatever modelers or subject matter aspects perceive in some domain, in some portion of the physical or social world around them. And the idea here is that the model that we generate should describe should capture this intended conceptualization that is in the mind of this modeler or this subject matter aspect. And in that, it should describe all the states of affairs that are considered admissible, and it should rule out those that are considered inadmissible, obviously always according to this conceptualization which someone wants to describe. And our purpose in what I'm calling here to assess the quality of these models is to ensure that these models reflect this intended conceptualization, because they will be used as a basis for understanding, but also for consensus building or agreement between different people, and eventually for the construction of information systems. But our view here is one of this conceptual model as serving as a reference for the understanding between humans, and not necessarily directly implementation. If we go to slide number three, we'll see we'll see a happy modeler here, and he has all these thoughts about what a domain looks like. You know, what entities that exist in this domain, the categories, the properties they have, the relations they may establish, and what he's doing in the task of modeling, which you can see in slide number four, is that he fleshes out this intended conceptualization into a model. And he uses a language for that, and he produces the symbolic artifact, which is the model. And his intention is that, if you see in slide number five, is that someone else that reads this model, which is this other happy person in slide number five at the right-hand side of the picture, that he will get across this message, that he will understand what was the conceptualization of the domain that was in the mind of this sender of this message, let's say, through the model. So if we are able to get this, then we get a meaningful interoperability, in the sense that we get someone to understand what was what are the concepts that are being included in the model. But what often happens is that problems occur, and then we can see one of them in slide number six, that perhaps what the model writes is not exactly which he actually wanted to write. Please go to slide number six. So the problems we can see here in slide number six is one in which the model is over-constrained, and it rules out many possibilities, possible instances, possible things in the domain that are actually valid but have been ruled out by the model. So this probably reviews one of the kinds of problems that we would like to review with our assessment techniques that may require a revision in this model. Now, another problem, you can see that in next slide, number seven, is that the model may be under-constrained. And so this may be, so whatever is implied by the model is too permissive and includes things that we would like to rule out, but that are not ruled out. For example, if we're talking about the genealogy ontology, this might be that ancestors can be the ancestors of themselves, or that there are loops in this ontology, there are loops in the cycles of parenthood. So this may be a mistake of the modeler, or it may just be that the language is not expressive enough to capture these constraints that were originally that one intended to represent. Ideally, we would have what we see in slide number eight, that would have a model with high precision and coverage, and that whatever is written in the model fits nicely with what we got. And okay, these characterizations here are all due to previous works, including that of Nicola Guarino, where this kind of precision coverage is discussed. My point here is just to make sure that we are on the same page, in that our goal is to have an expressive model that captures all these the domain as someone intended, and to make sure that the message gets across, one needs to gain confidence in this level of precision and coverage of the model that they write. So if you go to slide number nine, we'll see an outline of our approach. What we do is that we take as a starting point a model written in the AntoML language, which is a language that was developed by Giancarlo Guizzardi as a profile of the UML, and that we developed in the ontology and conceptual modeling research group back in Brazil. And this model, which is a source model of a transformation, which generates an alloy specification. which is then analyzed with this tool that was created by Vanner Jackson and colleagues at the MIT, which is called the Alloy Analyzer. And the Alloy Analyzer will be used here to generate instances of this model and further to be able to check some properties on the model. So if we're talking about simulation, then you have a random generation of instances of this model. So basically, the Alloy Analyzer will tell the story instantiating the classes that are in an AutoML model and showing possible configurations of objects with their properties to us. So we will be able to see visually instances of this AutoML model generated automatically. In the process, what we do is we capture additional axioms that are obviously not directly seen in this AutoML model as part of the Alloy specification. If you go to slide number 10, we'll see some characteristics of the AutoML language. It is a UML profile, so it is a lightweight extension of the UML class diagrams. In fact, a small subset of the class diagrams of UML 2.0. And it incorporates the theory in the unified foundation ontology, including additional finer grained distinctions between various types of categories of classes and categories of particle relations. UFO incorporates a number of advances and characteristics from Dolce and Otto Kling, and also influenced by the work on GFO and GRO, and this was the subject of Giancarlo Ghisardi's PhD thesis. These finer-grained distinctions refer to modal meta-properties of object classifiers. So there's a distinction between rigid and semi-rigid and anti-rigid classifiers. There are various meta properties for particle relations, which have to be, which are also included in the language, and other things which I will not have the time to discuss here. And perhaps the best way to see this is through an example, which you can see in slide number 11. Here's a very small example of a model in AutoML, which is a very easy to understand domain that is familiar to all of us. So we have persons that may have a gender, and they may be in different phases of their lives. They may enter in different relationships, like that of studying in some school or being employed by some organization. And also, to include an example of whole part relations, we have here the relationship between a person and their heart and their brain. This is an example that was chosen to illustrate across all these stereotypes that you can include with their different meta properties. If you please go to slide number 12, you see that focus on these the rigid kinds. In fact, those that apply necessarily to the instances that they, which are instances of these classifiers. This is, thus corresponds to some static classification of the objects that are instantiated. If you go to slide number 13, we'll see now some classes which dynamically type the objects that they that are instances of these classes. For example, here a student row, which is a relationally dependent class, which for someone to play the role of a student in a study relationship, there needs to be a school. For someone to play the role of employee, there needs to be some organization that is hiring them. These are those classes that are relationally dependent, and there are those that also classify instances dynamically, but that the criteria for classification is based on intrinsic properties of the object. In this case, that persons phases through their lives, so they may be childs, teenagers, adults. So what we see here is an expressive, let's say that UML has been enriched to include some other meta properties of the various classes. So when we exercise this model, we want these properties to be shown in simulation. If you go to slide number 14, you'll see also that we can characterize some sorts of dependence between elements. So the reified relations, material relations here that are called enrollment and payroll, they are existentially dependent on the persons and organizations that are being related through material relations. And also, you see here a tag essential in the relation between person and brain, showing that a brain is an essential part of a person. Thus, someone cannot just change brains, while in this particular model, they may change hearts. So heart transplants are allowed by this model, while brain transplants are not allowed. If we go to slide number 15, we also use these regular features of UML for generalization sets and the cardinality constraint. So we will also have to simulate and to be able to transform these into alloy as we go to the next phase. So if we take slide number 15, what we'll be doing is we'll take this model as input and we will transform this into alloy. And in slide number 16, you'll see that the objective is that the modelers will treat then this model as a black box. So they will generate all these instances and they will look at what they get from the instantiation. So they will not look at the model anymore, let's say in terms of its details, the stereotypes. They will go to the simulation of this. If you go to slide number 17, I would like briefly to talk about the alloy language. It's a language based on logical constraints, and what we'll get when we execute a specification in alloy, we get a lot of instances of the so-called signatures, which would be for us here objects, instances that are instances of our classes, and they respect the logical constraints that are in the model. So in our transformation, what we'll have to accomplish, and I'll not discuss the transformation here in detail, there are papers you can refer to that, is that we will have to include all the constraints that are implied by the theory underlying OntoML, which is that of the Unified Foundation Ontology. And one of the very important things that we need to get here in the simulation is to get a notion of progressing states, which will review the dynamics of this of the domain, and also review issues of modality. What is possible in the various worlds that are implied by the theory underlying this domain. And alloy doesn't have that. So that means we need to reify some notion of state or world, in fact, is what we reify to be able to produce this simulation. In the next slide, I'll talk a bit about the transformation, slide 18. What we do is that we produce this branching time structure with worlds being characterized as past worlds, current worlds, future worlds, counterfactual worlds. And so what we get in the end is not only this structure of worlds connected via accessibility relations, but also for each world, a set of objects somehow connected. That is an instance of the OntoML model. Please go to the next slide, where slide 19, where the model that is used, an example, is just enriched a bit because it was includes now identifiers and basically keeps the whole structure. And this model is, in fact, drawn in our research prototype that transforms into alloy, and then with which we are able to simulate the instances of this particular model. So in slide 20, we have the first world that is generated from this ontology. You have to understand that this sequence of worlds is just one particular run of the analyzer. If we would run it again, we would get a different one, and then a different one again, and in fact, not only a different structure of worlds, but we'd have different structure of worlds with different contents in each of these worlds. If we zoom in on this first world that is selected here in this slide, we'll see what we see in slide number 21, which shows us a past world where there is a person in the bottom of the picture with who we conveniently named here Alex, and he is a child, and he is a man, and he has a brain, which is here has a concept 6 name, and he has a heart, concept 11. He has a birth date. There is an organization in green called here concept 8, and this is just one example of possible world according to the ontology that we've shown before. If we go to slide number 22, we see a world just after this one. So let's imagine some things that have occurred. And in this particular world here, Alex has changed his age. So the integer that is associated to Alex is now a different one. Alex has now become a student. He is now, which means he's now enrolled in a school. So there now concept 8 is classified as a school, and there is an enrollment that connects also Alex classified not only as a child, as a man, and as a person, but also as a student now. He has the same brain. He has the same heart. If you go forward to slide number 23, we see still another world in this structure, continuing in following this structure. And we see here again Alex with the same brain, with the same heart, but now he's also employed by an organization, and he still studies in the same school where he studied before. So now not only he is a man, because he's necessarily a man, but he is also a student and an employee. These might be things where one might make questions. For example, should he be allowed to be a student and an employee? And other things that may show in simulation. If you go to slide number 24, we have the sad occurrence for Alex that he no longer exists. So the oval that was there, the blue oval, is gone. And now we only have these organizations that exist, and Alex is gone from the picture. And at this point in time, we can look at the world structure, and we see that there was a branch. So this is one of the possibilities, that Alex, you know, dies. But also, if you look at slide number 25, you will see another possibility, that Alex does not disappear from this history. In fact, what happens is that he still lives and he gets a new heart. So that's where you see that heart is a mandatory but not essential part of a person, and that the theory allows such kind of things as a heart transplant. And this might be, you know, this is just an example, but for any part, and you see parts changing, and the modeler will have to check whether this was what he actually intended. So someone may say, no, we actually did not intend for heart transplants to be possible in our domain. So these are the kinds of insights that you can get just from random simulation. And this would be very much like just running a program with some sort of random inputs. What we can do that I'll discuss now in slide 26 is that you can guide this a bit more, and you can do more than just simulation with this approach. And in fact, we have implemented a functionality to transform OCL into alloy, so you can enrich and have a more expressive OntoUML model with OCL invariants. And there are two approaches that we have used here in this tool. One is you can add progressively invariants and have them checked for consistency in the sense that you can have instances generated, and if the analyzer is able to produce those instances, then these invariants are at least satisfiable. Or you can add constraints which are invariants which you believe that are implied by the model so far. So, for example, one could, if they have an intuition that this model indeed guarantees certain properties of the domain, they could add these and have them checked. And the analyzer would be able to produce counterexamples in a certain size. Now, this approach is very interesting because we have seen in practice that very rarely, first of all, the bare UML model is not able to capture all the constraints, and this was something that we needed when we started simulating, and we found that there are many things that appear that were just there because the constraints were not specified. Limitations of the approach are listed in slide 27. And basically, one important limitation refers to scalability. What we're doing here is not theorem proving; is in fact enumerating with the model checker that is in Alloy, enumerating all the models up to certain size. So this is only tractable if the size of the instances is small enough, because we're going to do exhaustive exploration of all the possible instances up to a certain scope, and that is required for verification. This shouldn't be a problem if we appeal to the small scope hypothesis, at least if we give some credibility to this hypothesis that, in fact, the problems would be found in small examples. And this is defended by in the Alloy literature by Danielle Jackson and his colleagues. And we also believe this to be the case for OntoML models. One other limitation, which is that we only support models which are finally instantiable. So if a model only has infinite instances, then we cannot address them in our approach. In slide number 28, you see some conclusions. We believe that such kind of approach that allows us to gain confidence on the quality of the models with respect to what the modeler intended to write is required. If we don't do that, then it would be just like programming and never running a program until it's absolutely too late. In our approach, we focus on these dynamics of objects creation, classification, association, destruction, and we also exercise modality. So, for example, if you have anti-rigid classes, then we will go through show examples where the dynamic classification is applied. The idea was first to confront the model with what he or she wrote, but then this progressed into a more complete approach that allows verification of invariants, a generation of counterexamples, and you can find the tools available for download. These are the tools that you can use to model OntoUML, edit OntoUML models, and also generate Alloy and verify directly in an integrated way the Alloy analyzer. In slide number 29, I'd like to discuss some future work. The visualizations you have seen are very limited, and they're only based on the customizations of the Alloy themes. But since we can access an XML file with the structure behind the instances that was generated, we can do any kinds of arbitrary visualization techniques with that. And we're now working on this, and we intend to do some empirical validation of the techniques at least some comparison between different techniques and strategies for visualization of instances in OntoML. One thing missing is the support for temporal constraints or constraints that specify modality. So now we can only write OCL invariants on that apply to a single world. And we would like to be able to explore a trans-world constraint that would be richer. Another thing that would be very useful is would be to guide this analysis and verification of models. And one thing that is being worked on, and we have we already have some results on this by Thiago Salles and Giancarlo are working on this, is to have a catalog of patterns which reveals mistakes that mothers often do. So this would be the warnings of a compiler that you would say, and do you really mean this? So do you really mean that hearts can be transplanted? Do you really mean that someone cannot change genders and these kind of things? Because it might be allowed in a conceptualization. So we might have to give warnings or questions to users when these patterns appear. In slide number 30, you'll see some acknowledgments to Giancarlo Desari and to the students that worked with us, Alessandro, Bernardo, John, and Thiago. They have worked on these tools and they keep evolving them. And if you're interested in more on our approach, and you can read it, you can see in slide 31 some references to two papers that we have produced that would give this motivation on the approach, and that would also show our transformation. Finally, in slide 32, you can see again the URL for the ontology and conceptual modeling research group where you can download the tools. And I would like to thank also Todd and Terry and all of you to hear us today. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Sean Paulo. That looks like a very interesting tool. Before we go on, I've been asked to ask those of you who are on the call that have not signed into the chat to please do so. We'd like to know that you're there and be able to communicate with you, make this a more fulfilling session. Now, I think we can spare a few minutes if anyone has questions for Giancarlo, if you'd like to raise your hand. And in the interim, I have one for you, Giancarlo. You talked about the constraints right now. I guess it's performance constraints on the number of instances that you can deal with. What sort of range of instances? Is it in the dozens, hundreds, thousands?
It's in the dozens, yes. This is in terms of when you set the scope, the limits that you're setting is on the number of instances that will appear in the model that is generated, and also in the scope of the things that you check, right? The assertions you check, the invariants, which I have called. So this is in the dozens, and if you do more than that, then it will certainly be intractable. This all boils down to whether we can, by doing this exhaustive approach, whether we can trust this small scope hypothesis, right? Whether, if you're looking for counterexamples and the tool tells you there are no counterexamples, there might be counterexamples with a larger scope. But the kinds of defects that we see, they tend to be revealed in small examples. So I also see here on the chat some possible strategies. Amanda suggesting, for example, that we do some kind of sampling. We have thought about these things, but in fact, then the checking would not be exhaustive. But it could still reveal, if it reveals interesting counterexamples, then someone could manually inspect them. We have decided so far we have not explored those things. I think they're very interesting. But so far we are hanging in there a bit with the small scope hypothesis, and we'll try to exhaust that for a while, and then we'll look for more flexible strategies that would require some more knowledge from the modeler if we see that this is necessary.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Well, in the interest of time, if anyone has more questions they'd like to ask, please put them on the chat board, and I'm sure they will be answered. And hopefully we'll get some people to run out and make use of this and give us some more feedback on its ability to be used. I think it'd be a wonderful tool for modelers, and it's one of these tweens that Leo talked about last week. I believe it spans or bridges the gap between looking at an absolutely black box view of the ontology and dealing with things internally. And I think it looks like a wonderful tool to bridge that gap in a rather reasonable fashion. So, Terry, you had your hand up. Did you have something you wanted to add or ask us or tell us?
Simon Sparrow made some points about using sampling to provide a wider coverage that still would be statistically significant, so that you don't necessarily have to limit your test series to a small number, 15 or 16, as John Fodel, John was talking about.
Yeah.
The idea that you can find inflection points, nodes in the hierarchy which are particularly problematic, for example, and perhaps do a much broader test that still provides, with the appropriate statistics, a confidence in the results. Thanks.
Thank you, and as I said, this is a challenge for us to face in the sequel, and it would lead us to a very different kinds of techniques. But we're still sticking with the small scale hypothesis for a while, because we are getting very interesting results from the simulation. So it has credibility with us. Thank you.
Well, thank you again. Let's move on to our next speaker, who is Keith Silliman. He's going to be talking to us about system testing in the data world. Keith has spent several decades as a computer performance and systems performance analyst for various organizations in the United States. So without further ado, Keith, if you already hit star 7, and I assume, Peter, you have Keith's slides ready, please take it, Keith.
Yep.
Yeah. Hello, I think Terry's got the phone set up right. Are you hearing me?
I'm hearing you. I hope everyone else is.
Wonderful. On page 1, I just have a title page indicating what I'm going to talk about a little bit and who I am, how I can be reached via email. I need to maybe apologize up front that much of my terminology may be not in the tone or description you're using in terms of schema and ontology and things like that, but I think that at least hearing the two earlier presentations, I can resonate with lots of the comments being made and the statements being made, and hopefully you'll be able to see how what I'm saying might relate back, and hopefully we can tie it together sort of when we reach the end. Go to slide 2, please. Just an outline of the intent of what I'd like to say. I want to provide a little more background, a little more elaboration on who I am, what my biases and perspectives are in terms of my professional career. I've indicated a general topic of testing, looking at the two extremes of a very well-defined environment to be tested and a very well undefined environment to be tested, and then some sort of observations, maybe conclusions at the end to provide some degree of wrap-up or finalization. Slide number 3, please. My career has been primarily, well, it was in the data processing information technology business, and I've been reminded over the years that basically it's data-oriented. We're processing data, whether it's payroll data, personnel data, spacecraft data, environmental data, any other kind of data. It's all information-related. We're going to move data. We're going to input data. We're going to retrieve data, and things like that. So that's where I'm coming from. I've been in that business all these years. And as a contractor for the U.S. government, many different agencies of the federal government. So I'm afraid I bring biases and perspectives that may be a little bit jaded, a little bit different, but maybe then again similar to what many of you've experienced or know about. I've worked primarily in a system development, systems integration environment. However, many of my experiences have been involved with operational systems that continue to need to be evolved, to grow, to expand, to fix the problems that we heard about earlier. Customers realize that maybe they missed the mark a little bit when they first made their specification or first built their system, so they want to modify it, expand it, grow it, whatever. The American way is to grow things, make things better, supposedly, by making it bigger, faster, quicker, cheaper, those sorts of things. Also, my experiences have been primarily with large-scale, multi-year, multi-million-dollar programs. So these are frequently programs that take 3, 5, 10, 15, 20 years, or at least if not their development phase, at least their development and operational phase may last 20, 30, 40 years. In fact, one of the systems I worked with early in my career was the FAA's en route air traffic control system that many of you experience domestically, at least anytime you take an airplane. That airplane is being controlled by an air traffic control center across the country as you move from one sector to another, from one airport to the next, go from one altitude to another, shift back and forth between sectors and those sorts of things. So it's that kind of environment that my professional career was involved in. And specifically within that environment, I was in the performance engineering. For performance engineering, frequently after you build a system, people come back and say, well, it doesn't do something as fast as I expected it to, or it doesn't have the capacity I expected, and therefore performance engineering really is an opportunity or an environment where you can then modify your requirements and hopefully grow the capacity of the system or improve the performance of the system to make it more responsive to the users. And as part of that process, I've run the gamut from modeling and simulation using analytic models, discrete simulation models, measurements of using hardware, software, sampling, trace technologies. And then ultimately that pushes into requirements verification because a lot of the requirements that governments ask for is, capacities, responsiveness, things of that nature, and therefore performance engineering becomes a portion of the whole requirements verification, and then ultimately the evolution or refinement of the requirements. Let's go to page number 4 now, please. I'd like to try to bound the scope of what I want to talk about here a little bit. Cost and schedule requirements are very significant in the development, test, operation of a system, but I'm not going to try to even touch them here, although they have a very significant influence on the overall outcome. Similarly, facilities, utilities, logistics, where you house the system, how you get the power to it, how you resupply it, replace the parts, things like that, again, is another significant part that I'm not going to even try to approach or worry about. I'm going to focus on what I call performance requirements, where performance is not specifically related or restricted to just capacity and responsiveness, but more of, to use the flavor of an execution performance in this regard. So if we look at execution requirements, I believe, and you've earlier talked about it in some of the presentations about explicit, implicit, betweens. In a perfect world, you've got all your requirements completely defined. Everybody knows exactly what they're trying to accomplish and is being accomplished. The other extreme is what I call the black box, where no requirements are defined. We don't understand what it's doing, and therefore you try to derive the requirements or understand them by stimulating it. And those sorts of things. So that's where I'm going to try to focus my discussion are those two areas, and then try to look at, at the end I'll wrap up with some observations. The requirements tend to fall in explicit requirements, implicit requirements, or derived requirements, and then assumed requirements. And I'm always struck by the notion of people will say, I want this, I want it this way or that way or something else, but they haven't thought through the entire process and therefore don't know what the implications are. And so part of the process is an evolution of those requirement definitions as you work through the process. I used to figure it took at least three iterations to be reasonably complete in terms of defining requirements, and I've talked to program managers along the way that think that it takes at least four. So either phases, spirals, some kind of a phase of a development effort, you're going to have to go through multiple ones of these to, in fact, get things right, and the question is, how right do you want them to be? Let's go on to now slide number five, please. So if we look at, the well-defined world of a system, frequently, at least from my perspective, you get hardware components and software components. In the software, you frequently have data and you have algorithms. Historically, it's always been a case when performance problems develop, the software folks say, well, the hardware folks have not provided me adequate hardware. And the hardware folks say, well, the software folks haven't implemented it correctly. So there's frequently this kind of conflict or back and forth between the different sides of the house, but we need to really address both of them and the integration of the hardware and software together. And I look at under hardware and software, obviously one of the issues is, are we working with the correct details, the specifics, mostly in data? Do we have the right data in our database that we're accessing? Do we have the right algorithms that we're processing that data with? And are they complete and sufficient? I'm reminded of several years back, there was a publicized failure of a Mars probe that apparently didn't get to Mars, unfortunately, because they found out the root cause, they believe, was that somebody had used miles versus kilometers as the value that they should have been processing. So they were looking at possibly miles, and they should have been using kilometers, and therefore they were off by the whatever it is, 0.38% or 38% or something like difference, and we lost a significant Mars Explorer vehicle headed toward Mars because of a problem with correctness. The sufficient hardware and host system environments, this is a capacity issue where people ultimately have to ask the question of, okay, how much work can this system do for me? What's the capacity of that system to accomplish things? If we move on to then response, which is an area that I frequently focus on, is that, you can't say, obviously, or mostly you can't say absolutely what the maximum response in a system is going to be. And very often customers and people I've worked with and myself try to limit or bound that problem to say, let's look at a 95th percentile of responses meet the maximum of n seconds or whatever the interval be. So you basically, for response time, you want to look at basically upper and lower bounds. And again, in my work in the industry, sub-second response times were the sort of the demanded values, the expected, and mostly obtained or achieved. But unfortunately, there are a few occasions where you have these outliers or very large queries, very large retrievals, very large transactions that fall outside of your 95th percentile, maybe a 99th or 99.9 percentile. And so what do you do with those kind of issues, and how do you manage that? Reliability, availability, maintainability are issues that someone has to pay attention to. For those who may not be familiar, reliability, how often does a system break? When does it not continue to satisfy my user? Availability is really a far extreme of performance. If the system is not available to perform for seconds or minutes or hours or days, then obviously you get very poor performance. Then maintainability has to do with how do you evolve, grow, replace as products become obsolete or things like are replaced by newer products. And security is depend on your viewpoint, either a black hole or something like that, where, what level is necessary or required. Some people become very paranoid about security. to the point of they electrically isolate their boxes. They put them in steel boxes and walls so people can't hear what the electrical signal emanation and things like that. But frequently now it's a network issue, so we have opened up many of our systems to the world, where you now get hackers from around the world that want to penetrate, either for nefarious reasons or just for the fun of it or whatever. Let me go to page number 6, please. So this starts to address, I think, more of the problems that this group is focusing on. And, you know, I don't have an answer. It doesn't sound to me like there is an answer, but, you know, so maybe some thoughts from my perspective as to what I've seen is, how do you bound the problem? How do you, refine the issue down to small enough pieces that you can actually resolve or solve, whether that's the 10 or 15 instances of something or, simple requirements, things like that. So it's, frequently a stepwise refinement or reduction of requirements. And maybe in some cases you have to start from no knowledge whatsoever. And, the industry I've worked with, they talk about straw man proposal, straw man requirements, straw man starting points, but then over time, as you refine, resolve, answer questions, you firm them up, become, ultimately Iron Man and Steel Man and whatever, so that you get final requirements along land. In this black box of world, after you've tried to establish your requirements, you need some kind of correct calibrated inputs. What are we going to stimulate this black box with to see how it behaves, what its response will be, and how frequently or how often or how quickly it responds. But you need to define an expected response up front. You can't just go in and say, let's stimulate the box and be surprised when the response you get isn't or with the response that you get. So you need to define an expected response, again, maybe a straw man or something like that. Then you basically stimulate the box with those calibrated, corrected inputs. Measure your responses for correct content and timeliness, and compare your response with expectations. If very frequently your response does not compare with the expectations, and therefore you have to then try to resolve, try to investigate, try to determine, where did I go wrong, either in what I expected, or my input wasn't what I thought it was, or the box isn't behaving the way I thought it was should, or things like that. So there's a need to do this, stimulate, measure the response, compare the response with the expectations. And obviously, then at that point in time, because they frequently don't match or don't match absolutely, is, what do you do different for the next iteration? And the iteration until you're going to modify your inputs, you're going to modify your expectations, maybe you're going to modify the environment the box is in to ultimately reach to the point where your expectations and the responses match. Some of the discussions earlier had to do with the combinations and permutations of a box or a system are basically intractable. You can't do them all. So the question is, what do we do to bound that kind of a problem? And I suggest that we need to look at inflection points and boundaries. Very often in an environment where you start running things, you might find that a response or the behavior of a box might be a flat line. And at some point in time, it might change from a flat line to a linear increasing trend, where slowly over time, the response it takes, process more data, increases on a linear basis. And at some point in time, that linear basis becomes some other than linear, exponential or hyper-exponential or something else, where you reach some other limitation in the system. So I would contend or postulate, propose that what you need to do is start with your boundaries, look at the low boundary, if you can estimate a high boundary or an upper end boundary, and then look for the inflection points through some kind of a sampling technology. I like to use powers of 10. So if you increase the size of a query, increase the size of the database you're searching, or things of that nature, by powers of 10, then look at those points to see if you can find those inflection points. Let's go to page number 7, please. There's a lot of uncertainty in test environments, and it reduces, obviously, risk in the whole testing process. And I would contend, propose, postulate that the objectives of the testing is to reduce the uncertainties and risks. You want to basically derive what reality is, if you can, come up with things. Now, some observations I've found in historically working, some of the things that impact inflection points that I've seen, the host system environment just may not be up to the task, or it may reach some point because of an error or other condition where, in fact, you go from either a flat response time type or to a linear to an exponential or something like that. Memory leaks and data fragmentation is a problem at application and system levels that's kind of tough to deal with. Garbage collection by some of the operating systems, have to happen periodically. That's going to impact response, impact capacity of the system during that processing. The amount of memory you have determines how frequently you have to go into garbage collection. The amount of garbage collection you have to go through is a function of how much is out there, those sorts of things. And ultimately, if garbage collection isn't successful or you've got too much fragmentation, at some point in time the system stops running, availability is impacted. Error handling recovery is another area. You might talk about fragmentation. Memory leaks is basically just a portion of error handling and recovery. Specifically, I have identified a case where very often what happens when you reach the edge, the boundary of your log file, whether it's a user log, a archive log, some other kind of a log, or maybe even a boundary or a limit of your database. What happens when you try to insert a record into your database and there's no space left? So there's an issue of error handling recovery. Data volatility, obviously the data that's more volatile will cause more updates, more reorganizations of your data. Again, we're back to a little bit of the fragmentation question. If you have volatile data, you're inserting and deleting data, basically you're going to develop fragmentation in your database. And at some point in time, you have to reorganize that. Again, impacting availability, maybe performance of the system. Distributed data, it's people, sort of frequently look at data from the standpoint, well, it's computers are going to take care of that for me. I don't have to worry. Unfortunately, in very large environments, sometimes you find that based on the capacity of a system, that the data that you want to access, frequently, the new data goes in at the end of the old data. And frequently, in a lot of systems, the most frequently accessed data is the new data. And so we tend to have hotspots develop in that sort of the wave crest of the end of the data as the new data is being added and the new data is being accessed, reviewed, updated, whatever. And this is not only just a matter of mechanical devices. On the old rotating memories, the disks, it was very obviously a problem. It's still a problem in very high volume data environments where you have access pathway and control unit limitations in terms of how much physical access can you do through a cluster of data, whether this is a mass storage device, a RAID-type technology device, a unit, things like that. In large enough worlds, those continue to be a problem. And lastly, I want to talk about a little bit of environmental concerns. Temperature, humidity, pressure, radiation, gravity, these are topics that you may not think about ever impacting a system. However, we had a very dramatic case 10, 20, 30 years ago with the shuttle explosion that was launched on a morning that was very cold. And so in that case, we had a system failed because the design didn't accommodate temperatures below freezing in that case for the launch. And another case is if you're into a space-based environment where you have very small memories now in spacecraft sometimes are subject to radiation. And so if you get a cosmic ray go through your memory array, it may flip bits. All of a sudden, the data you thought you had out there is changed. And so you need to worry about, again, kind of the error handling, error recovery kind of a problem. There's unexpected issues, but how do you plan or prevent those kind of issues? That's my kind of a summary point. Happy at this point stop.
Thank you, Keith. You'll notice on the chat there have been a couple of comments about how relevant this all is to ontology. And Peter's pretty well covered the response I would have given. The short answer is, if you put your ontology in the cloud, all of Keith's problems were solved. Not. As your ontologies grow and become more essential to the critical path parts of real applications, then eventually you begin to reach the point where these issues become irrelevant and germane.
Jerry, if I may?
Sure.
I want to address some of the concerns that were voiced about Keith's presentation. I like Keith's presentation because, in fact, it brought up some issues that have not been addressed. And he gave us a system perspective, that is, a non-ontologist perspective. And I think that's very important. Why? Because we want to have ontologies and the supporting infrastructure used in systems. Subsequently, we will have to be able to address and interact with in an effective fashion those people who are not ontologists. Specifically, he was talking about testing. Now, I don't know how many of you have worked with professional testers, but they're certainly not ontologists. So one question we're going to have to address, come up with a good solution for, is how do we get the testers to communicate the errors that they are uncovering in terms of what changes may need to take place in the ontology or its supporting infrastructure. Another aspect that he brought out was this issue of, you know, from a testing perspective, you're supposed to know what to expect. Well, what occurred to me is Gianpaolo's talk may provide a way to give you some of those expectations automatically. That is, if you have a small set of instance data, you could perhaps generate the expected values and pass those on to the testers. And then the other issue that was brought up is the requirements, which we're going to hear more about from our last speaker, Amanda. You know, what are those requirements? How can you write the requirements so that you can create a test so that the testers will understand what to test and what to expect? So from a systems perspective, there's a lot of things that as a community we haven't addressed because unfortunately, we haven't had the need to yet, but we do have to get to that point where we're going to have to address a lot of these things which are not immediately ontology-focused, but they are crucial. So, for instance, you know, he was talking about reliability. What does reliability mean for an ontology? And, of course, well, one thing might be we can trust the results that come out of it. But there are probably other aspects of reliability that I haven't imagined yet. So with that, Keith, if you have any response?
Well, I think I've been somewhat successful in provoking some discussion. Yes, I'm afraid I'm not into the ontology world, so I don't even hardly speak your language. And maybe that's a real problem, and I think you've already pointed out, is, you know, if we're all speaking in our own tongues, you know, how do we expect the world to either understand or respond to us if they don't understand what we're saying? And so I think this is helpful if nothing else, to share with you, again, my biases and perspectives in terms of the kind of environments I worked in and the problems I faced.
So, yes, and thank you for bringing to us that broad system perspective without the bias that we all in the community have, which sometimes we can't get over.
Can I put in a last word?
Okay.
20-some yes, years ago, early in what I thought was the industry, there was an author, Jerry Weinberg, wrote a book called, I think it was Introduction to General Systems Thinking. It's probably long gone off the library shelves. I know my employer 20 years ago closed their library and threw the books out, and I think I scavenged it out of the garbage pile. But if any of you are interested, I found it at least 20 years or so ago when I read it to be very interesting and thought-provoking. So just a last postscript. He was originally known for a book called Psychology of Computer Programming or something like that.
Okay. Well, we're going to have to press on to make sure Amanda has sufficient time. So without further ado, Amanda Visedom will speak to us on From Business Requirements to Ontology Evaluation, a Process Outline. If you would, Amanda.
Thank you, Todd.
Have fun.
This might flow better than I thought it might, because what I'm going to do is start us from a systems perspective and talk about how that comes down into an ontology perspective, how the two fit together in a certain way. So I'm taking the extrinsic considerations topic from a different angle. Rather than focusing exclusively on the extrinsic characteristics of ontologies, I'm going to talk about extrinsic requirements and extrinsic considerations and how those lead to a definition of the requirements that should apply to any given ontology and the evaluation that should be applied within a project. So my slide 2, if you would. This is the focus and agenda. Focus I already just discussed somewhat. And the agenda, I'm going to outline a process that starts with business or operational requirements. And I've got those starred to so that I remember to say I'm using those fairly interchangeably here, business and operational. They aren't always interchangeable, but at this level, they're close enough. For those participants who are more accustomed to an academic environment, let me just explain to you quickly that in industry, governmental, any big organization these days, when people are talking about process and so forth, they use business to simply mean mission-driven activities, not necessarily money-making ones. So that said, business and operational should be within this presentation as pretty much interchangeable. And the result of this process I'm going to outline is essentially an ontology evaluation plan, or the components of one, that can be used to guide the development or the selection of ontologies for a particular project towards those that will actually be most functional for that project. I say outline of a process because obviously, given time, this is going to be high level and rough. It could easily be a half-day workshop if it had detail. but I will, after presenting that process outline, walk through a particular example and talk about how this would work, how this can look in a particular example. And let's see. Let me just say before I actually go on to the outline, a little bit about the motivation. We have a lot of knowledge distributed around the community of particular kinds of evaluation, particular ontology characteristics that can be relevant to suitability or quality. And a lot of what we've been doing in this summit is sort of bringing that scattered knowledge together so that we can, you know, understand it as a body of knowledge and all have the benefit of it and think more sort of critically about the what needs to be developed more and what all we have to work with. There's still a question of how do you select from all that, and there's been a little bit within the summit a little bit of expression of sort of overwhelmness, like, well, this is great to discover these kinds of the research on evaluation techniques and the tools and everything that, and the actual practices people are doing. It's great to discover it's happening, but now how do I know what I need to do? That's happened a little bit in the summit. It's something I've encountered many, many more times outside of the summit. Anytime, I don't think I can think of a single exception. For the last 5 years at least, every workshop, conference, meeting, anything that I've been at, there is at least one person there whose organization is starting up or wants to start up some project that involves semantic technology, and they are absolutely lost to figure out what they need. So this process is aimed at that problem with an evaluation focus. So slide 3, start the outline. There are 7 steps or tasks at a high level outlined here. I say steps with a qualification that in reality, this may not be linear, and in most cases, in a real project, you're going to have feedback and, you know, iterations and so forth. Some things, you know, may go on in parallel and then feedback to each other and go on. Again, the emphasis here is in thinking about these tasks individually and how they enable each other and how they enable us to get from the extrinsic context to the technical specifics that we need. And structure that you won't see here in terms of what the life cycle is or how these things are ordered, in most significant projects, assuming they take place within some larger technology projects, not just finding an ontology, there's going to be a life cycle definition and approach that comes in that project. So, you know, the organization that is sponsoring or inducing this project may operate using agile techniques, or they may operate using specific other software engineering or systems engineering models, and that is going to both define the overall project lifecycle and provide a framework for defining the ontology life cycles within it. So that is something I'm not trying to tackle here. Okay. That said, still on slide 3 here, the first step here, I say identify business requirements. I say received. What I mean by that is usually when an ontologist walks in the room, that's already been done, right? It may not have been done in any particular detail, but something is a problem for an organization or entity, and it's a problem for them not because they think the technology should be more elegant, but because they need to do something, or they need to do it better, or they need to do it more accurately or more cheaply. So generally, the business requirements in step 1 is something that is coming from roughly the same level as the funding is, for example. Right? This is a high-level group. They are not going to speak ontology. They may not even speak anything technical whatsoever. So step 2 is the first step where some non-business discipline gets applied to that. No, this is a step in which there's interaction between the sponsor or client or intended users and the technical experts, in which the technical experts who know they come in with some experience, some understanding of what choices need to be made in designing the system. They can ask questions of the operator to find out what are the needs that that will answer that will force those choices. I'll say more about that in a minute. That's enough for now. Some examples of requirements that might be elicited at that point that weren't in the first point might be, you know, the content of the information that's going to be handled, the interactions expected in some detail, the conditions those interactions will happen under, and some of the processes or actions that might use the results of the semantic technology. Now, two should result in some more specific, still operator view, non-technical requirements. That's at a certain level of detail. Step three is when the technical experts translate that into system capabilities and functions that are required, as well as non-functional requirements, certain things like cost or something like this. Now, you might be surprised to see four separate from three, but I've done that for a very specific reason. Step three is system level. At this level, you have an understanding of what the system as a whole needs to do. Step four, I've emphasized the ontology here and the and other components in parentheses, but after the technical requirements for the system are specified, those requirements need to be allotted out to system components. So this is something that involves using an understanding of the technical possibilities to figure out what components, subsystems, or combinations could be put together to deliver particular capabilities. What are the options for doing that? How, you know, what combinations of things do we need? I'm calling it out here that there's a need for this step, which is normal in you know, general systems and software engineering. There's a need for this step that's no less critical when one of the components is an ontology. I'm calling that out because I'm seeing too many cases in which that's being skipped. Either entirely, if the project is entirely at the semantic level, it just may never be done. Or if there's a larger project going on with a semantic subsystem component, it may be done for everything except the semantic subsystem, which is treated as a black box in the requirements. One symptom of this, which I also see too much, is a project that's a year or more down the road that started with the mistaken belief that, say, for example, an ontology alone without any accompanying ontology using software will deliver some particular functionality, or that any ontology or semantic technology will deliver some particular capability, when actually, you know, it's a very specific combination of components or capabilities that you need to do that. And they've gone ahead and built or bought the wrong part because they did figure out what this breakdown was going to be. So step five, identify ontology evaluation elements. So in step four, this should have resulted in requirements specifically for the ontology. Oh, wait, I'm going to back up for a second. Step four again, where I talk about the ontology requirements. I just have that listed as a single step, but when the ontology requirements and the other component requirements are identified, those may well have implications for each other. As an example, I worked on a very large scale semantic technology project in which ontologies were part of were being built to play a particular role, and an infrastructure was being built to utilize those ontologies to enable some discovery, and there was no communication between these teams. The infrastructure, the environment, had requirements for ontologies that it could consume and use. Because that's a downstream system, those become requirements for the ontologies that are being built. They have to be consumable by that environment or that system. But there's no communication of that because this process had not been done. So this is very important to note that each component within the system may entail requirements for others, and that includes the ontology. Okay, so now, got the ontology requirements. Step five, we are looking at identifying ontology evaluation elements. This is where...
Amanda, you're running low on time. You might want to speed up.
Okay, sorry. This is where we start moving into looking at the various aspects and metrics and methods that we have been talking about in various sessions and figuring out which of these map to certain requirements, like what is available that can measure whether a particular requirement has been met. And that may be a loose collection of multiple option elements, right? So from there, there's a step six of using the specialized ontologist knowledge of what's out there and trade-offs and so forth to come up with recommended details that then the project plan level folks integrate into the general project plan. Now, on slide four, let's do this briefly. This is the same process, just some notes about what kind of expertise required. This is my take, really, on the what Leo calls the intrinsic tweens, extrinsic. What I call the tweens more the combined relational category, where you require both ontological and extrinsic knowledge. This is sort of my take on this. In this color scheme, the blue things require understanding of the business operational context. Most things in here do. The green things require technical expertise. The dark green is specifically ontological technical expertise. So you'll see many things have both shades of green because they need a little of each. And the blue is more of a project management kind of strength. And this is important, again, because of the failure to incorporate these different kinds of background knowledge into the appropriate steps often causes results that don't work, that don't reflect, that aren't good specifications. I am going to skip over the next two slides because I've really already talked about that. And I think I'm going to skip all the way. So let me just say, actually, on slide six, the steps two through six on the left there, those are really the ones that are ontologist essential, right? That's where the ontologist's focus is going to be, where you need to have ontologist or ontological knowledge involved. slide 7. Here, I'm zeroing in on just a couple of the individual steps as transitions, just to highlight how particular steps bring us from the extrinsic to ontology concerns through to the technical requirements, where we're mostly looking at things that require ontological expertise to understand and evaluate. Slide 8. Here, I'm zeroing in on the technical requirements to talk about the fact that even what we're doing is starting from the extrinsic considerations, and we're moving to the specific technical requirements for the ontology. Those technical requirements themselves will typically be a mix, right? Some of them will be specifically ontological. Some of them will be a mix, requiring both environmental, your context knowledge, and technical knowledge. Some of them may require both ontological and non-ontological technical expertise. On slide 9, there's an example of how one of these, I have this reasoning support shows up on the previous slide as one of the technical requirements, and notice that if you break down reasoning support, you know, among the things you get is, are these specific properties of ontologies that we generally view as intrinsic, the things that are best supported often from an evaluation perspective and often best understood by ontologists. And I'm showing this to show that even when you have an operator or business requirements focus, it doesn't mean that these good old, characteristics, technical characteristics we're used to don't matter anymore. They generally still do. Other things matter as much in many cases, or at least as well. But if you're going to provide the functionality that's being called for, in most cases, you need some of these core characteristics to be met as well. So slide 9 is just saying, well, if you're needing any reasoning at all, you need at least consistency, use according to formal semantics, and some level of representational capability that's specific to the reasoning you want. Slide 10, another example, if you need as a functional requirement the meaning of represented information to be preserved over time, over user communities and so forth, then you need some of these formal properties as well. So example, I'm going to breeze through this. I'm not going to talk about everything on the slides, but I'll leave that open for questions afterwards. So what does this look like? We're going to talk about Fred Corp. This is an enterprise search story, slide 12. I'm not going to read all this, but the bottom line is Fred Corp is a typical mid-sized corporation. They are drowning in internal documents, records, email, whatever, things they've generated. They have clients and offices in multiple countries. They've become overwhelmed trying to find things that they want. Somebody gave them the idea that this some semantic search solutions would work. For various reasons, they decided they didn't want to buy them. They want to build one. Okay. They want to build their own. Slide 13. This is what I mean when I say there may not be much to the first step business requirements. It will usually not be technical. It is not at all uncommon to enter a project with only this level of specification. We want to do search and retrieval on our internet docs. We want to do better than the stuff we've tried so far. Anyone should be able to find anything with certain limits, and we don't want to have to pay company X lots of money over years to keep it going. Slide 14. Okay. Slide 13 note is not enough information to specify a system, right? That's obvious to the technical person. It's not obvious to the person who doesn't know very much about semantic technology. Slide 14 is the kind of thing that happens, and even this list is not, you'll see the three dots on the bottom, it's not meant to be complete. Can't really do this 20 minutes or an hour. This is what happens when some technical folks who are, you know, somewhat experienced at doing this work with the business people, ask them questions, and find out what functionality they really need. Okay, I'm going to let people read that on their own, but this is still non-technical speak. This is still business requirements, right? But it's refined to a level that you can now start to make choices, technical choices based on it. Slide 15, just a few from Dunn here. Now somebody with technical know-how who understands what's out there how it can, you know, might deliver that functionality, sits down and translates those detailed business requirements to technical requirements. Now, it's not fully in technical language here because I'm just trying to highlight it on a slide, but you can see the kind of thing we've moved from certain capabilities to the user to understanding that you're going to need a structure analysis, text analysis engine, blah, blah, blah. Slide 16, okay, now they've got technical requirements. Breaking this down, I'm going to pause for a second on this one because this is not done enough. Sometimes they'll start with the system requirements and think, okay, so I just need an indexer and an ontology, and maybe I can use some of the ones out there. This is one where it's broken down to say, okay, well, to support all those functionalities that system has in it, that ontology has to have some very specific characteristics. For example, this is going to be multilingual. You've got to have, I should actually say cross-lingual, right? You can search in one language, get document in another. You have to have nodes or concepts or synsets that have lexicalization in the multiple languages you're using. You've got to have enough representational expressiveness to capture the concepts in the FredCorp domain and in the internal business domains of the support units like HR and IT and so forth, whatever shows up in those documents. Now, slide 17, from there, you can derive some of the evaluation elements. What did we just talk about? Well, you have to have the concepts that are in those documents. Well, that's beautiful. You've got a corpus, right, against which you can measure coverage to a certain degree. You can check whether you can look and see in automatic fashion whether the concepts that are entered have the relevance affecting relationships specified. That is, the relationships that you're going to use when you decide whether or not to return a given document for a given search. Slide 18. From there, the ontologist can recommend particular evaluation steps that should be taken. May be able to also say when, if you have a sense of the life stage of the the life cycles of the software system in general. And also, I insert here that this is also the point at which the ontologist is feeding back to the project level information about what happens if you don't, what are the risks that happen if you don't evaluate certain things. And that includes things you couldn't come up with a metric or method for. And 19, the final incorporation of the ontology evaluation recommendations in the project plan. That's something the project managers generally do, but ontologists should be providing input and validating that and seeing that relates in a sensible way to the other components of the project. So, you know, if you're saying don't break the build with all the rest of the system, you should be saying it with the ontology, right? The ontologists should be getting both the same responsibility, accountability, and the same opportunity to detect faults before the break, before they break the build and correct course. And finally, the very last slide is just the same thing we've already, you've already saw up above. I've just added a couple highlights. Three is highlighted in yellow. That's an area where I think we need more shared knowledge. There's actually quite a lot of knowledge out there about what a semantic system can or should do to meet particular kinds of operational needs. Answering those questions involves a good understanding of the capabilities and limitations of different kinds and combinations of ontologies and semantic technologies to accompany them. So that knowledge exists, but it isn't shared as widely or as evenly as it should be, and we need it to be in order to see more successful projects. I highlighted 5 and 6 because there we've got a bit of a deeper problem that really needs to pull into the research community. We don't understand, we don't have enough understanding of how particular metrics and methods relate to particular requirements. Again, there's more knowledge than is shared, but we need more. a lot of it is research amenable. There's a lot of good work that could be done here. Even just finding correlations would help in some cases. And certainly more tools that are easily available and usable to perform those evaluations. And that is the end.
Thanks a lot, Amanda. You actually finished up well within your time budget, so we got plenty of time for questions. So we'll look at see if there's anything on the chat. Has anybody raised their hand? I guess that would be the first question. No hands raised. Well, so if there are any questions, just there's Peter. Peter has a question. Go ahead, Peter.
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Great. Amanda, as I put down on the chat, this is a great process, and as those who are aware, we are going to be running a hackathon and some ontology clinics, hopefully, and application clinics. I mean, this will be spot on. I mean, in terms of providing a process for someone to sort of go through an application clinic. So we definitely hope you could get involved
proposals. Absolutely. I'd love to.
Yes, that would be great. And while I have the floor, I want to draw people's attention to the announcement, the call for hackathon and clinics proposals. They are due next Thursday, so we have exactly one more week, and I don't see a lot of discussions on the forum, the Ontology Summit forum, and then a few on the Ontolog Dev mailing list. There's not a lot. Either people are quite ready or they at a loss on where to start, although we had a couple of meetings before. So I am proposing one more meeting next Tuesday. So for those people who would be interested in participating, let's have a meeting next Tuesday at 7 a.m. Pacific time, 10 a.m. Eastern time, and 4 p.m. Central European time. That way, any last-minute question or partnering could be done on an interactive and synchronous basis. I also put down on the chat, earlier to Yao Paulo and Giancarlo Usati to invite them to participate on the hackathons. I extend the same invitation to everyone who have developed or are stewards of ontology, of software environments and ontology tools to consider participating in turning in proposals to those calls. And besides just participating in the hackathon, we also are coming up with a survey on software that are pertinent to ontology evaluation. Michael Denny and Ken Pukowski is sort of three quarters of the way ready to deploy a survey. But the important thing is not to develop the survey. The important thing actually is to have people responding to the survey. So this is a call for everyone who's running tools to please, when the survey comes out, please respond to it. Also, since you are in the business of developing tools, get your friends to respond to the surveys as well. We will be posting interim results since this is likely to be on the wiki so people can see who has responded and who hasn't. And if you know of tools that should be responding to the survey and you haven't seen those people respond yet, help us nudge your colleagues or friends, or at least give us a pointer so that one of us could reach out to them to have them respond. So that's like three or four calls all bundled in one. So back to Terry.
Yeah, thanks, Peter. Michael Gruninger, you have your hand up. Why don't you go ahead, please?
Yeah, so this is a question for Amanda then, because I think one of the key ideas is, you know, extracting the notion of ontology requirements, because I mean, that's really when we're talking about evaluation, we're talking about evaluation with respect to requirements. And way back, like when the early sessions, Megan Katsumi presented an approach where ontology requirements were characterized in terms of the underlying models, and similar to Paolo's talk. But with yours, could you maybe just elaborate a little bit more, like in your slide 16 with the ontology requirements? How would you see, what guidance could you give people to specify ontology requirements from your perspective?
Okay. Yeah, that's a tough one. That could have been a talk on its own. But it's a really good question. So in a way, I view the requirements, identification as a selection process, in a sense. You know, you can look at all the things that we've talked about as evaluation aspects of one kind or another. You could think of those as a menu of things an ontology could have, and some of them are in degrees. So you could say, well, an ontology needs to have this degree of coverage of this corpus, if you're talking about lexical. Some things people talk about is if they're in degrees, but they're sort of both degrees and types, like representational expressiveness. So that, you know, one of the first things you have to ask is, if you're talking about either an IT system or, this is still an IT system, although people don't think of it that way, an IT exposure, right? Something that's providing information to the world. Then you need to have enough representational expressiveness to capture the meaning of the data you're putting out there. If you're doing any reasoning, you need to be able to capture a certain level of reasoning, but also a type of reasoning. So, you know, do you need probability in there? Do you need uncertainty in there? How much do you need to capture about the source of any given assertion? All of this can be, it could be a matter of the ontology language. If you're looking to develop your own ontology, you know, you need to look at it when you're choosing the language, and then you need to look at it in the final product. Or if you're selecting ontologies for reuse or evaluating them for reuse, then, you know, again, it's more like the final product level. But I don't have a checklist or chart, and I don't think that we have one collectively as a body, which is why that stage is in. They got the yellow circle on the final slide, but what I put on slide 16 is sort of a hit to some of the most common, or the ones that jump right to my mind as areas where a requirement needs to be specified in almost every project. What breadth of coverage do you need, from whose perspective, or comparable to what working domain, or in support of what working domain? What reasoning is going to be needed? What level of lexicalization? Are there downstream components that need something from the ontology, and if so, what do they need? And how much is it going to be? Is this a one-off project? Is this going to be incrementally extended? Is it going to be maintained for a long time, and so forth? That's not as neat an answer as I'd like to have, but it really does. I think this is true of requirement specification in most kinds of software projects, maybe systems as well, but there's a lot of implicit knowledge that goes into this process right now, based on the experience of the technical folks on a project. Oh, which reminds me, I wanted to say one other thing about this. Part of the importance of here is, and actually technical requirements for the whole semantic technology project, I see a lot of projects get going, especially see this in the very large enterprises and government entity projects, where they staff up the whole thing at once or contract out the whole thing at once. And that effectively, when they have no internal ontological or semantic technology expertise, that, in my opinion, is a big mistake, because what you get in steps 3 and 4 is going to tell you what. If you already committed that you have certain kinds of programmers and certain tools and so forth, you've done that based on no real knowledge of what you need to develop or buy. So this is a side note, not an answer to you, Michael, but you just reminded me of it.
Okay, cool. Thanks.
I hope that helped.
Yeah.
Thanks very much, Amanda.
You're welcome.
I was in the process of writing up a little bit on the chat, but basically, I think your chart, page 15, your step 3, is the place where you would irrevocably, or maybe not irrevocably, but seriously commit to using an ontology. The first two steps don't necessarily mean that you need to use an ontology. But at some point, you have to decide that you're going to.
I think that's correct. I think that a good, and this is, I find a lot of agreement at the technical lead level here. Maybe not so much at the commercial lead, but most people, most technical lead type folks in the ontology area, many do have some experience with other related kinds of technologies, and part of what we sometimes wish somebody had come into a project with that background knowledge at step 2 and step 3 and said, this doesn't actually look like it needs ontology. Maybe it needs taxonomy, or maybe it's actually just, it's a one-off and it's not, and you have no SMEDO, you have no domain expert availability or something like this. It's not going to work. Either way, it may be something where it's not going to be an ontology project.
Right. You can go to CCITT and get some standard data structure for your message transmission.
Yeah. On the other hand, in step 3, you haven't committed to what – you've committed to system capabilities, and that may certainly implicitly – it may implicitly – commit you to some ontology presence, but it's in step four that you commit to what that ontology is, what load is that going to carry? And that's important. As I mentioned, I've seen too many cases where people don't even realize they need a reasoner if they're going to do some, you know, it may be just very low level reasoning they need, but they don't realize they need one at all. Or they don't realize that they need, you know, something else that uses the ontology in one way or another. So, and they don't realize, how a particular requirement is met by a combination of things that way. So four is really where it divides out to say, okay, well, how much ontology and what kind, what flavor.
Thanks again, Amanda.
Sure.
I was practicing saying Paulo Almeida. I hope I'm pronouncing. And I got my tongue twisted into the wrong language. I want to thank all the speakers for today. Todd had to leave, and for that matter, so had Keith. Keith left, but Gianpaolo and Amanda, particularly your presentations both covered areas that we really need to explore more deeply, I think. And I guess with that, if there are no more questions, we're done for the day. Peter, you got any last word?
Again, what you've already done, thank everyone. But join us next week, same time, next Thursday. Leo Oberst and Steve will be hosting session number 8, Intrinsic Aspects of Ontology Evaluation 2. So let's talk then. Great session. Thank you.
Bye-bye.